Hello again, everyone, wherever you may be, and welcome to the 141st edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Welcome, Laura.
Good evening, Dennis.
Laura, we have so much to hash out on this broadcast, including former Republican U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who lost his job last week because of a small group of disgruntled Republicans. But we must begin tonight with that horrific story coming out of the Middle East and the reaction of Republican presidential candidates who were campaigning in Iowa this past weekend. Everyone knows the story. Israel formally declared war against Hamas today after Hamas militants launched thousands of rockets into Israel and after militants crossed into Israel in numerous locations. Israel has fought back. There have been many casualties. It's a horrific situation there, Laura.
It is. I think they've now confirmed more than 1,000 deaths, but there are still many people unaccounted for. There are hostages. At least 11 of the dead are U.S. citizens. There are other foreign nationals. So as you said, it's just a horrific loss of life.
And the Prime Minister Netanyahu said today in his words, what we will do to our enemies in the coming days will reverberate with them for generations. Nothing good comes out of this situation and often does not come out of any situations in the Middle East. But
this, I mean, Israel has experienced many terrorist attacks, obviously, but this is by far the largest loss of life in a single coordinated attack. And I saw that if you compared to the proportion of Israel's population, this would be as if 25,000 Americans were killed on 9/11 instead of close to 3,000.
And they are calling this their 9/11. So we wish them well. We wish them extremely well on this Monday night. All right, the presidential candidates, many of them were in Iowa this past weekend, the Republican presidential candidates. Naturally, they all talked about Israel. All of them supported Israel. We're going to talk briefly about what each of them had to say, starting with former President Donald Trump, who was in Waterloo and Cedar Rapids. He said Israel would not have been attacked if he were president. Laura?
Yes, former President Trump spent quite a lot of time. Both of these speeches were more than an hour long, and I did watch them both in their entirety. And he really spent quite a lot of time on foreign policy. And this was a recurring theme that Russia would not have invaded Ukraine if he were president, or we would have a better relationship with China if he were president. And also, as you mentioned, that this as Israel would never have been attacked if he were president, that only he can solve the situation, only he can deal with it. He was very critical of President Joe Biden on many counts, and also blamed Biden. He said some of the things he said were inaccurate, but he talked about a prisoner exchange with Iran in very negative terms.
Trump also said in his words, we are closer to World War III than we have ever been, and I am the only one that will prevent World War III. Typical Donald Trump stuff.
Yes, I mean, that is definitely a recurring theme that he is the only one who can do, the only one who can bring manufacturing back, the only one who can save gas-powered cars, and on the foreign policy, also the only one who can save America. That is clearly the major theme of his campaign.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was in Ankeny this past Saturday. He condemned the attack on Israel, as did everybody else, and said, in his words, we stand with the state of Israel. This is a time for moral clarity.
Yes. And I think that he may have been the first presidential candidate I saw who really got very specific, accusing the Biden administration of enabling Iran. The state of Iran does provide support to Hamas, the organization that was credited with the attack. But the intelligence analysts I've read said that there is no evidence that Iran was directly involved in training or funding this particular attack. I think there's a lot that we don't know about this developing story.
Former Vice President Mike Pence, also in Iowa, condemned the attack by Hamas militants, and he had an interesting quote, a memorable quote. He said, if the world knows nothing else, let the world know this, America stands with Israel.
Yes, and Mike Pence, his entire campaign, he is appealing a lot to particularly the evangelical Christian bloc within Republican circles, and that group of Republicans are among the strongest supporters of Israel. This is something for our older listeners, they may remember there was a time decades ago when in some ways the Republican Party was perceived as generally less supportive of Israel than the Democratic Party, and that I think is no longer the case. It's very strong bipartisan support for Israel has been a feature of American politics really for the last couple of decades.
And Nikki Haley and Tim Scott also issued statements, both of them supporting Israel, saying Israel has a right to self-defense. So it was unanimous across the board. Nothing surprising here. Republican candidates support Israel.
Yes, and I think Tim Scott also really leaned into blaming the Biden administration, accusing President Biden of funding the attacks on Israel. And that really struck me because I'm old enough to remember other international terrorist incidents, like, for instance, the Lockerbie bombing, and that we just didn't used to see this kind of reaction where people in the United States would immediately blame the U.S. president for a terrorist attack that occurred in another country.
Well, as we said before the show started, it's a different time in American politics, and these kinds of attacks, unfortunately, are commonplace now.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it is certainly different from how American politicians used to talk about foreign policy issues.
Meanwhile, President Biden condemned the militants, of course, and pledged to make sure Israel has what it needs to defend itself, sent carrier strike unit into the Middle East waters. He's doing what he can. He's going to hold a conference, a news conference, tomorrow, Tuesday afternoon, as we go live on Monday night. And he's doing what appears to be as much as he can at present.
He's been speaking to a lot of world leaders. I know the White House has released some readouts, some summaries of his conversations with the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and others. So he's certainly been working on the crisis.
And it is unanimous among Iowa leaders. Both GOP Senators Chuck Grassley, Joni Ernst said the U.S. has to stand by our allies. Governor Reynolds said much the same thing. And every member of the Iowa congressional delegation backs Israel, of course.
Yes, and Governor Reynolds ordered flags to be flown at half-mast in commemorating the loss of life over in Israel. That Marionette Miller-Meeks and Ashley Hinson, who represent Eastern Iowa, they both visited Israel relatively recently last year, and they have reflected on that in some of their remarks. But yes, as you say, universal support. The 3rd District Representative Zach Nunn said that he is preparing a bipartisan resolution that he's going to be working on getting supporting Israel's urgent requests for assistance. As we're going to discuss a little bit later, it may be difficult for Congress to act on those requests quickly.
Actually, we were just about to segue into that because there is a problem in Congress right now that we're going to talk about. But in summary, there is no disagreement among the Iowa delegation, no disagreement among Republican politicians, and virtually the entire Democratic Party. It's bipartisan support for Israel, not universally, but almost there.
Almost there. And I think that when Congress is able to pass some kind of an aid package, it will pass with overwhelming bipartisan support in the U.S. House and Senate.
Well, until Saturday morning, the story about Kevin McCarthy losing his job as Speaker of the U.S. House was going to dominate this broadcast, which just goes to show you shouldn't put the broadcast together too early. And we don't. We are always able to change it. What a week it was in the House of Representatives last week. We're going to go over it step by step. Kevin McCarthy lost his job as Speaker of the House. The first time in the history of this country a House Speaker had been ousted. He was ousted in a coup, basically, by his own members, a few of his own members.
I mean, this motion to vacate has very rarely been used. The last time it had been used, attempted, was more than 100 years ago. That was an unsuccessful attempt. And as you said, a House Speaker has never been ousted, other than their party losing a set of elections and being replaced in the following year's session. But it was quite remarkable. On the other hand, and many people saw this coming early in the year because the Republican majority is very slim, and Kevin McCarthy angered a lot of people on all sides.
Think about this. Kevin McCarthy got 96% of the Republican vote in the House to remain as Speaker, and he lost because 8 Republican House members joined 208 Democrats in favor of ousting him. Democrats would not come to McCarthy's side on this.
No, and the reporting seems to indicate that Kevin McCarthy did not directly ask Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic minority leader, for any support. I think that there may have been a calculation on the Republican leadership side that Democrats would come to his assistance on the grounds that maybe anyone replacing Kevin McCarthy might be worse. But the problem is, Kevin McCarthy really angered, as I mentioned, a lot of people. He had tried to blame Democrats for the close call with a recent government shutdown. And a lot of Democrats were very upset that he voted against certifying the 2020 election result and that he made a deal with President Biden a few months ago to avert a debt default, and then almost immediately went back on that deal to try to support the deep spending cuts that his own caucus wanted. So he really was left without any friends on the other side of the aisle.
The revolt against McCarthy was led by Florida Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz. He has been excoriated, Mr. Gates has, by every major newspaper in this country that takes an editorial position. He appears to have no agenda except chaos, and he generated it last week.
Yes, he did. And Iowa's House members, Ashley Hinson, was the most directly critical of Matt Gaetz. She delivered one of the speeches on the floor during the debate over whether to remove Kevin McCarthy as speaker. She gave one of the speeches supporting Kevin McCarthy. And while not naming Matt Gaetz, she referred to chaos agents and people who would rather have chaos than work constructively for the American people. But also Marionette Miller Meeks, very critical of the effort. Zach Nunn was very critical of the House spending time on the motion to vacate the speaker. And I thought it was interesting that Randy Feenstra, who of course represents the most Republican district in Iowa, made no public comments. He did support Kevin McCarthy in the vote, but he didn't release a press statement. He didn't post anything on social media. He didn't say anything pro or against Matt Gaetz. And I think that he probably wants to avoid some blowback from some of his own constituents.
So the House has been in recess because they can't conduct any business. They have no speaker. We have a couple of people who have already announced their candidacy from the Republican side. One of them is Jim Jordan of Ohio, who became the first to announce he's going to run. He's the House Judiciary Chair, member of the Freedom Caucus. The other is House Majority Leader Steve Scalise of Louisiana. So Democrats did not support McCarthy, but I'm just not at all sure that they would be happy with either one of these gentlemen in the Speaker's chair.
No, and a third person who hasn't formally announced but seems to be laying the groundwork, and maybe he's trying to position himself as a possible consensus candidate later, is Kevin Hurd, who's the leader of the policy conference that's a very conservative group of Republicans. And one thing to know about all three of these people, Jim Jordan, Steve Scalise, and Kevin Hearn, is that like Kevin McCarthy, they all voted against certifying the 2020 presidential election. So, I mean, there is no moderate candidate versus conservative candidate, for instance. I mean, Jim Jordan, you could say, is more of an insurgent type of Republican, but Steve Scalise is also considered to be very conservative within the caucus.
So Ashley Hinson and Marionette Miller Meeks endorsed Scalise, and Donald Trump, of course, stepped in after there was a report that he might be willing to be drafted as House Speaker. He then stepped in and endorsed Jim Jordan.
Well, I thought this was quite interesting that Hinson is very close to Republican leadership. In her first term, she was appointed to the Appropriations Committee right away. That's relatively rare. She's worked closely with Elise Stefanik, who right now is in the number three position in the House GOP leadership and could potentially move up to the majority leader position if Steve Scalise is elected speaker. And so I think that may have influenced Ashley Hinson's decision. As I mentioned, she was tapped to give one of the speeches supporting Kevin McCarthy. But I thought it was interesting that she and Miller Meeks, they came out of the gate pretty early. They were among the first members of the House to publicly endorse Scalise. And I wonder if they would have done that if they had known that Donald Trump was going to come out the next day and confirm that he endorses Jim Jordan, because generally they have been quite cautious and have not publicly taken a position that's contrary to Donald Trump's.
But wait, there's more. Just when you think you've heard everything there is to hear, today, Monday, Kevin McCarthy, who said last week after he was deposed he would not run for speaker again, went on the air with Hugh Hewitt on his national radio show and said he, Kevin McCarthy, would be willing to return as House Speaker. So this is wild.
I mean, I was very surprised that he came out almost immediately within hours of the vote last Tuesday and said, I'm done. I'm not going to attempt to be speaker again. Because I think most people expected that he would try to cut some deals and make similar deals to what he did in January when he needed 15 ballots to be elected speaker. I mean, that was something that has rarely happened, certainly hadn't happened in the last 100 years or so. And so I don't know what he's thinking. I mean, it's hard to imagine Jim Jordan getting 200, and I think it may be 217 that they need rather than 218, because there are some vacant seats right now. But it's difficult. There are, I think, 18 House Republicans who were elected from districts that voted for Joe Biden. I think that could be difficult for them. But then, of course, the people, including the eight who voted to remove Kevin McCarthy, they're not going to settle for anyone who's considered to be on the moderate wing of the party. So it really could take quite a few ballots. And I don't think anybody has a handle on how this is going to play out.
The House GOP was scheduled to meet tonight, Monday, in a closed-door meeting to discuss what happens next. Then tomorrow, Tuesday, the conference is going to hold a delegate or candidate forum at 4 o'clock Iowa time. And Wednesday, it's going to hold an internal election for speaker. Now, all of this taking place, no formal vote on the House is set yet.
That's right. I think the idea is that internally they will elect a candidate, and then when they come back and debate in open session, just one person will be nominated and the whole conference will vote for that person. And so they won't have to go through these 15 ballots or something similar, like what happened in January that was very time consuming. And I did, as I mentioned earlier, Randy Feenstra has not commented on this at all. I mean, his weekly newsletter, you would never know that anything unusual happened in Washington last week. There was no reference to the House being paralyzed, having no speaker. What does he think about that? And so I wonder if people like Randy Feenstra might be hoping that they can get out of the situation without publicly taking a side, right? That I think the internal vote will be by secret ballot, and then hopefully that it'll be all decided. And so when they take a public vote, they'll just be with everybody else, and they won't have to put up who their first choice was.
You know, it's just possible we're going to talk about this again next week on Capitol Week.
Absolutely. And meanwhile, the federal government is only funded through November 17th. And so the clock is ticking, right? As you said, the House cannot conduct any business until they have a speaker. And now there's going to be an urgent need to approve some kind of aid package, most likely for Israel. But again, they can't take up anything like that until they have a speaker.
Speaking of the clock ticking, thank you for that segue. It is 16 minutes and 17 seconds after the hour. It really is. And this is KGY's Capital Week with Laura Bellin and me, Dennis Hart, your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa or around Iowa or what affects Iowa. We're here every week at this time to talk about what's been happening. And you know what? There's been a heck of a lot happening. Let's go to the Capital Week Caucus Almanac. Oh, my, the National Democratic Party and the State Democratic Party tried to make news last week. It's official now, Laura. The decision, this happened on the weekend, the decision to officially dislodge Iowa from its first in the nation status in Democratic presidential nominating processes.
Yes, and really anybody could see this coming a long time ago, and particularly after last December when President Biden came out and said that the Democratic Party shouldn't allow caucuses as part of the nominating process, and he proposed a calendar that didn't include Iowa as an early state. But I think all year, I mean, a running theme has been Iowa Democratic leaders responding to every discouraging step in the process of saying, well, there's still a chance and we're still going to make our case. And we think that we have a strong case for remaining first. And so finally, last Friday, they confirmed publicly that they have acknowledged they're going to conduct only internal party business at those precinct caucuses on January 5th. They will have this mail-in presidential preference, and they won't announce the results for that until March 5th, which is Super Tuesday. So that's outside that early state window.
So think about this. People will vote. They have a chance to vote in the caucuses, but their results will not be announced until the same day that a dozen other states, including California, are holding their primaries and caucuses. So the news is going to get buried.
Yes, and that was a question about who decided to announce it. Maybe it would have been a better idea to announce the results on a different day. I mean, there are a lot of logistical questions. I ran an article by John Deith, he's worked for the Johnson County Elections Office as his day job, but he's also been very involved in organizing the Democratic caucuses in Johnson County. And he raised a number of questions. The Iowa Democratic Party has not released a lot of details about this plan, but who's going to hold these ballots? I mean, will each county party have a secure location to store the ballots? How's it going to work? What if some people show up at their precinct caucus on January 15th, holding one of these presidential preference cards, and they want to turn it in then? So there are a lot of questions about how this is going to work and how they're going to be able to keep the results under wraps until March 5th.
All of these events happening mean you and I will have a job on this broadcast for the foreseeable future.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and by the way, the Iowa legislature session is going to open about a week before the Iowa caucuses on January 8th. So it's just going to be just a little bit busy in January for us.
Well, you know, it was a little busy. It's been busy all year for us every month on this broadcast. There's been no down day. All right. This afternoon, there was breaking news all over the place this afternoon, this Monday afternoon as we go live. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., still talking Democrats here, dropped his Democratic presidential bid. He was running against Joe Biden. He says he's going to run now as a third party candidate and independent. Laura, who's he going to hurt the most, Trump or Biden?
Well, this is all of election Twitter, and I'm still going to call it election Twitter, even though the site is officially known as X, has been debating this for the last week or so when news leaked out that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was going to be running an independent bid. And I think paradoxically, many people think that despite the Kennedy name being so popularly associated with Democrats, that it may hurt Donald Trump more, because the polls this year have shown that Republicans have a very favorable opinion of RFK Jr. He's been very critical of the COVID response. He's been known for anti-vaccine statements. And Democrats, I mean, he has a very upside down favorable, unfavorable rating with Democrats, but not so with Republicans. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. Of course, a lot of voters do not follow the political news closely. And so if they just see the name Kennedy on the ballot, many people may still assume that he's a Democrat.
Right. And before this news broke this afternoon, there was reporting that the Trump campaign was worried about RFK Jr. and they were preparing to go on offense against him because internal polling showed he would hurt them.
Yes, I think initially when he declared his candidacy as a Democrat, a lot of big Republican donors supported his campaign. But last week, there were some reports that probably not directly the Trump campaign, but more like a PAC or a super PAC associated with Trump is going to be running some ads attacking RFK Jr. So I presume that they must have some internal polling that shows that he may pull some support away from Donald Trump. And that wouldn't surprise me at all.
All right, let's go back to our caucus almanac with more candidates coming in. Go back to some of the candidates who were in Iowa this past weekend. We talked about it a few minutes ago in relation to Israel, but there were other things they talked about. For example, Ron DeSantis in Iowa this weekend also talked about the border. He said he's going to get Mexico to pay for building the wall that President Trump promised, but he's going to get Mexico to pay for it.
That's right. And this is one of the problems that Ron DeSantis has had, is that he's tried out several lines of attack against Donald Trump. I mean, he said that he isn't sufficiently opposed to abortion, that he can't beat Joe Biden, and now that he didn't complete building the wall on the border. And I think that what's frustrating for him and his team is that none of these attacks seem to be sticking. In fact, Donald Trump at his rally, I mean, he seemed to really relish taking some shots at DeSantis. He got applause when he did that. And I noticed last week that there was a story about a group unaffiliated with the DeSantis campaign, but a major dark money Republican group that had done some focus group work, and they had tested out 40 ads, 40 anti-Trump messages with Republicans, and none of them were effective in diminishing support for Trump. So that it's just a problem. I forgot to mention that DeSantis has also criticized Donald Trump's COVID response, but you know, none of this really seems to stick. So I'm skeptical that this line about how he's truly going to finish the wall, that that's going to pull a lot of people, a lot of Iowa Republicans to his side.
And DeSantis's PAC also unveiled some ag endorsements in Iowa, and there was reporting that he's running on fumes in terms of money. DeSantis has $5 million in cash available for the primary. There is this growing feeling that I'm sensing and hearing that DeSantis is making, this might be his last stand in Iowa.
Yes, I think that this is his last option. I mean, he's no longer in second place in New Hampshire, and he really, I mean, if he doesn't do well in Iowa, then the primary campaign is basically over for him, because he doesn't have a natural, he's not leading in any state in the South. He's actually not even leading in Florida, but he's certainly well behind in South Carolina. So he doesn't really have a better option. I mean, the DeSantis campaign has been low on funds for a long time. And that's why the super PAC Never Back Down is basically organizing all their events, doing most of their advertising. The bus tour, all of the public events were organized by Never Back Down, and Ron DeSantis is the special guest. So this is how they get around the laws against coordinating between PACs and campaigns. But I think, you know, they're trying to run a very traditional campaign, right? Like a week or two ago, they unveiled religious leaders for DeSantis, and now they have the Farmers Never Back Down Coalition. And then earlier in the year, they had the Mamas for DeSantis. But as you've mentioned on previous shows, I mean, Donald Trump is just a phenomenon that we've never seen in recent history. And so it's hard to, you can't beat him running. This is more of a traditional building blocks of an Iowa caucus campaign, but it doesn't seem to be getting any traction.
So he doesn't appear to have any momentum. Nikki Haley may have some momentum. It's hard to know whether this is hopeful reporting on the part of liberal news media, but she's expanding her footprint in Iowa. The New York Times reporting she's raised $11 million across her political committees. And today, late this afternoon, more breaking news. Former Texas Congressman Will Hurd dropped out of the race for the GOP presidential nomination and threw his support to Nikki Haley. The question is any of this real for Nikki Haley?
I think it is real, and here's why. Because the Iowa caucuses, they've always, there's been a saying of for a long time that there are three tickets out of Iowa, right? You don't necessarily need to win, but to be relevant, you have to at least finish in the top three. And Nikki Haley seems to be going for this kind of suburban moderate. I wouldn't say that she's exactly a moderate Republican because she doesn't have the issue positions that we might traditionally associate with moderate Republicans, like, for instance, being pro-choice. She's certainly not pro-choice, but she is making overtures to pro-choice voters. She is making overtures to suburban moderates. She has been more critical of Donald Trump than some of the other candidates. And Will Hurd, of course, was extremely critical. I mean, the thing his short-lived campaign will be remembered for is when he came to the big fundraising event in July and said, Donald Trump is not running for president. He's running to stay out of prison. And he basically got booed off the stage. So, but I, now, can Nikki Haley win the Iowa caucuses? I don't think so. But are there enough moderate Republicans to put her in a solid second or third place position? Very possible. I mean, 10, 15, 20%. I don't know, but there is a significant block of moderate Republicans in Iowa, and they're looking for a candidate.
All right, we have about 3.5 minutes left. We're going to zoom here. While all of this was going on, Vivek Ramaswamy's campaign got buried in this mess of a report about what the campaign said was his campaign vehicle being intentionally hit by protesters outside a coffee house in Grinnell. Grinnell police say that's not what happened. The Grinnell student newspaper said that Ramaswamy's campaign vehicle was parked illegally when it was struck. Why did this mess come about?
Well, I don't know, but I have communicated with Zach Spindler Craig, who is the Grinnell student journalist who was there. He literally saw the collision happen. He had, was covering the event and he saw it happen. And he said that there really is no evidence that it was intentional. It was a distracted young driver, a Grinnell student who was backing up the way, as you mentioned, the Ramaswamy campaign vehicle was illegally parked. So it was jutting out a little bit more than it normally would be. And she was trying to back out. She was trying to drive back in the direction she had come from. So instead of just backing a little ways from her angled thing and going up the street, she was kind of backing across the street and trying to turn the car all the way around. And it was just a very distracting scene. So I don't know, but I did notice that quite a lot of the national media seemed to run with the Ramaswamy campaign allegation. And I haven't seen any evidence. As you say, the Grinnell police didn't find any evidence that the vehicle was intentionally rammed or anything like that.
All right, back to state politics. Laura loves this. Republican Iowa State Senator Brad Sohn of Urbandale said he's going to seek re-election to Senate District 22, and this is going to be a very interesting race.
This may be certainly one of the top targeted Iowa Senate races in the whole state. This is the northwest suburbs of Des Moines, the Polk County area of Urbandale, Johnston, a few other places. And this district, Sohn was re-elected by a narrow margin in 2020, but this district is more Democratic leaning. This is a district Joe Biden carried in the 2020 election over Donald Trump. And the Urbandale Democrat, Matt Blake, he just held his formal campaign kickoff event on Sunday evening in Johnston. And the Democrats are going to fight really hard. And you may say, well, who cares about an Iowa Senate race because the Republicans have such a large majority. But remember, Republicans have exactly that two-thirds majority, 34 seats out of the 50 in the Iowa Senate. So even just bringing down their majority to 32 or 33 would be significant for Democrats. It would mean, for instance, that they would have the ability to not confirm some of the governor's nominees.
1 minute and no more, Laura. You reported that the charge has been dropped related to State Senator Adrian Dickey's RAGBRAI incident, and that was a strange one.
Yes, it was. So this was a simple misdemeanor charge, interference with official acts in Sac County on a rural road. He had said it was all a big misunderstanding and he was innocent. And the Sac County attorney on Friday filed a motion to dismiss the charges. He basically said that they didn't think that they had enough evidence to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, that Dickey, the defendant, had asked for a jury trial. And just given the allocation of resources, that they thought it would be in the interest of justice to dismiss the charge. Adrian Dickey did agree to pay the court costs. So this thing is going away. He does still face a civil lawsuit that was filed by his daughter in July, but that will take probably several more months to play out.
Well, Laura, we're almost out of time for this broadcast, but we're both going to be watching the U.S. House of Representatives very closely this week.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sure there will be a lot to report. And who knows, we may or may not have a speaker, but we'll certainly have news to report next Monday.
Will it be Scalise? Will it be Jordan? Will it be Kevin McCarthy? We don't know, but we're going to find out together. Hey, that's a great line. We don't know, but we're going to find out together.
Well, it could be somebody completely different. I mean, when they decided on Dennis Hastert, he was kind of the default after they had explored several options following Newt Gingrich. And then that Bob Livingston had to step down right away. And I think Dennis Hastert ended up being a compromise candidate everybody could live with. So we may end up with some kind of a scenario like that.
It may not be Dennis Hastert, but it certainly won't be Dennis Hart. Okay, we're done. A reminder that the views... Why are you laughing, Laura? That the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI. That hurts my feelings. Or its staff. Laura and I are going to be back here in the same time slot next week, and as usual, we're going to talk about everything involving politics. We hope you have a safe, healthy, and go ahead, have a happy week.